today, how the richest countries have grabbed an unfair share of the global vaccine market and why they may come to regret it. The speed that the world scientists have managed to create not one, but several effective COVID vaccines has been close to miraculous. It's simply never been seen before. More than 300 vaccine candidates are now in development, and 200 million doses have been jabbed into the arms of grateful citizens. But those lucky people are overwhelmingly found in just a few of the world's richest countries.
90% of Israelis jabbed at least once, and many of them twice.
This team will help get at least 100 million shots in the first 100 days.
This country has achieved an extraordinary feat, administering a total of 15 million jabs.
For the rest of the more than 5 billion adults around the world, things are looking less hopeful. Many will have to wait up to 3 years if they can get a jab at all. Writing in The Guardian, the Director General of the World Health Organization said the Me First approach of rich countries might serve short-term political interests, but would ultimately be self-defeating.
I need to be blunt.
Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus called it a catastrophic
moral failure.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the great global vaccine divide. Michael Safi, you're The Guardian's international correspondent. Let's start with where we are at globally with this pandemic. How far has COVID-19 travelled?
It's circled the world a few times. There's only a handful of places on the planet that are reporting no cases. They're mainly islands in the Pacific and Atlantic Ocean.
The coronavirus pandemic is showing no signs of slowing down.
Koronavirüste toplam vaka sayısı 73 milyonu.
Le nombre de morts a dépassé les 2 millions.
Worldwide, we've now passed 2 million deaths due to this pandemic.
We have 115 million cases of COVID confirmed. I mean, the real figure, maybe 5 or 6 times as much at least. We've confirmed about 2.5 million deaths, but again, the real figure may take years for us to really know.
It feels to me that although this has clearly been a global threat, the response has been very nation-based.
We've all been up against the same enemy, the same tiny opponent.
In fact, Boris Johnson himself described it as countries fighting individually against this common enemy.
But members of the UN have still waged 193 separate campaigns.
Is that how it has played out?
Definitely. I was talking last year with someone who had helped design this kind of global health infrastructure that was developed after SARS in the early 2000s and was supposed to kick in to help us manage a future pandemic in a better way. And the thing that had shocked her most, that as soon as governments realized what a threat it was, they immediately withdrew from all of these. They just didn't abide by them. They immediately reverted to a nation-based response. On a purely rational level, makes sense because, you know, they're answerable to their people before those of other countries. But it's a folly because you can't actually defeat it in one country and feel like it's gone. We are a connected world. A pandemic is a global threat. You can only really defeat it on a global scale.
And obviously we'll come to the vaccine, but in the early days, what did that nation-based response look like?
Well, there were a few notorious examples. One was the difficulty of actually getting hold of PPE.
Now, Berlin's city government has accused the US of an act of modern-day piracy after a shipment of 200,000 protective face masks was hijacked on its way from China to Germany.
You might also remember the scramble over ventilators. And I think perhaps the most notorious example was that for a brief period last year, there was a drug called remdesivir that was thought to be helpful in treating the virus. We no longer think it really is so useful anymore. But back in the middle of last year, when that was the idea, the US government announced that it had struck an agreement with the company that made remdesivir to make almost all of their production over the next 3 months available only to Americans. They basically bought up the global supply.
My administration has secured 90% of the world's supply of the drug remdesivir, which is having great impact.
The source of a lot of outrage, because understandably everyone else in the world said, well, what about us?
And that response you're talking about was early on. It was around lockdowns, border closures, masks, testing and so on. But quite quickly, much quicker than anyone expected, the conversation pivoted to vaccines because we ended up having not just one, but several. And it felt hugely optimistic.
Pfizer executives are calling it one of the biggest medical breakthroughs in the past 100 years.
Breaking news this afternoon, a new potential COVID-19 vaccine has been announced by the biotech firm Moderna.
Britain's Oxford University and its pharmaceutical partners AstraZeneca have published the preliminary results from large-scale trials.
Did that competition that you're talking about translate into this area as well?
Certainly. So on the one hand, there was the rhetoric. So at the very beginning of the pandemic, governments such as China's, such as Germans, the French, were calling the vaccine a global public health good. They were saying this is something that must be shared as widely as possible. It needs to be as accessible as possible to the world. But then on the other hand, governments were negotiating billions of dollars of doses of prospective COVID-19 vaccines with pharmaceutical companies to reserve as much vaccine as possible for their particular country. So, you know, most notoriously, Canada has managed to reserve 5 times as many doses as it would have required if all of the candidates that it did reserve, you know, would actually become vaccines. The UK reserved 3.5 times its population's worth. It became clear pretty quickly that when vaccines were discovered, if they did manage to succeed, that we would begin to see a similar level of nationalism applied.
And so is this what people mean when they say vaccine nationalism?
Essentially, yes. Vaccine nationalism is when a government prioritizes vaccinating its own population over the rest of the world, especially poorer countries that can't afford to be part of this total frenzy of reservations of vaccines that we saw throughout 2020.
You've mentioned some countries, but more broadly, what are the examples that we've seen of vaccine nationalism?
The best way to look at this is to group countries into their income level. So according to Duke University, high-income countries have reserved 4.5 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccines.
As we set out this weekend, we've secured 2 million further doses, meaning that we in the UK now have access to a total of 357 million doses of 7 different vaccines.
In contrast, low-income countries, so the poorest countries in the world, only have about 670 million doses. And so wealthy countries have reserved about 8 times as many doses. They've totally crowded out the market for the next year at least.
And you're describing this as a kind of affluent country versus poorer countries. But it's not quite as simple as that, is it? I mean, there are some affluent countries that are racing ahead and others that seem to be struggling. And there are some developing countries like India, which seem to be rolling out a massive vaccine program.
Definitely. I mean, there are small things here that make a big difference. India has its own vaccine manufacturing capacity, so it can make its own vaccines. And of course, it's going to keep enough to vaccinate its own population. On the other hand, we mentioned Canada, which reserved so much vaccine supply, but isn't producing any of them in Canada. And so it's found that while it can sign contracts, it's much harder to guarantee that you actually get them in a timely fashion.
All of that is what we've come to know as vaccine nationalism, but we also hear this term vaccine diplomacy. Are countries doing things to try to improve the spread of vaccines across the world?
They are in very strategic ways. I'll give you the example of Serbia. You know, Serbia is a small country, not particularly wealthy, and yet it has the highest vaccination rate on continental Europe. Now, why is that? It's because it's strategically located. It's on the periphery of the EU. It's been courted by China. It's been courted by Russia in the past. As soon as COVID vaccines started to come online, China and Russia have both lined up to try to sell vaccines to Serbia. And Serbia now has so much domestic vaccine supply. It's actually been practicing its own vaccine diplomacy. It's been giving vaccines out to countries like Montenegro that are sort of in its sphere of influence. Because of this shortage in vaccines, because of the inequitable distribution of vaccines, it's created this opportunity for countries to go in there and sell vaccines, donate vaccines, and in doing so, curry favour and influence and lots of good press.
And how do some of the countries that you've mentioned look on the vaccine diplomacy side on this? How does the US, Canada, and the UK look?
Well, so far, they have been absolutely laser focused on vaccinating their own populations. I mean, that's been their priority. And they haven't really yet turned their focus to other parts of the world. You know, we're told regularly that as soon as the UK or the US have enough vaccine for themselves, they'll start giving it away to other countries.
It's very important that the UK will continue to support vaccine rollout across the whole world. Forgive me, we're one of the biggest donors in the world. There's no point in having a vaccination program that is simply confined to one country.
Someone my age in the UK faces quite a small risk of dying from COVID compared to a health worker in a country like Ghana. So there's no logical reason why that person in the UK should be vaccinated before someone who is exposed to COVID every day and is in a far more vulnerable position.
Logical on a global level, maybe, but we are all governed by individual countries. Is it any surprise that politicians are looking out for their own citizens first?
Not at all. I mean, anyone who looks at the world would have guessed that this was exactly what was going to happen. It seems logical that every country would seek to look after itself, would seek to vaccinate itself first. But actually, a lot of research and a lot of evidence is telling us that vaccinating the world, making sure everyone gets vaccinated at roughly the same rate, it's firmly the self-interested thing to do. A study last month found that hoarding COVID-19 vaccines could cost wealthy countries at least $4.5 trillion in lost income just in 2021. It makes the point that wealthy countries cannot vaccinate themselves and then seal off from the rest of the world. That just isn't the economy that we have. It's going to ultimately slow the recovery and delay by years, the amount of time it will take for the world to start looking the way it did at the beginning of 2020.
Wow, so those costs are based on the idea that the pandemic lasts longer than we think, that we have to keep restrictions in place for longer than we think, and it disrupts the economy.
The global economy is so intertwined, and so if a country like Bangladesh has a terrible COVID-19 wave at the end of 2021 and has to shut down, that's going to have knock-on effects for Western economies. It puts numbers on what we all actually know already, which is that this is a pandemic, it affects everybody, and if the virus is running free in parts of the world and leading to shutdowns and making people sick and killing them, then life in the UK is not going to be normal. Life in the US won't get back to normal for a long time.
And to what extent is that concern based on the idea that if COVID is continuing to grow in certain countries, then it increases the likelihood of variants that will be able to bypass the vaccine?
I mean, that's one big part of it. I mean, definitely. I mean, we're seeing that now, that like such uncontrolled spread gives a lot of opportunity for the virus to produce variants, to mutate in a way that can evade whatever immunity we've built up through the vaccine. So that's definitely one part of it. Beyond that, you have the problems of travel, you have the problems of global supply chains. I mean, it's just the UK could just throw the drawbridges up. It could vaccinate itself and seal off and you know, cut its global links. But obviously that would be not a return to normal. It would be the creation of a pretty terrible new future.
So are there countries that are nowhere close to having the COVID vaccine?
As of the end of February, there were 130 countries that had yet to receive a single COVID vaccine dose. We were at a point where 10 countries, just 10, had administered 3/4 of all vaccinations in the world. And there would be no real prospect of improving this situation if not for a program that is low profile, but actually quite radical and ambitious. And that's COVAX, the brainchild of WHO, an organization called CEPI, and another one called Gavi. 192 countries around the world have bought into COVAX. It's sort of a mechanism for the equal distribution of vaccines. And the wealthy countries paid a lot more to join. And what that did was that subsidized vaccines for poorer countries.
What is the scale of COVAX? How many people are they trying to reach? And how successful has it been so far?
Over the next 6 months, COVAX plans to give away more than 300 million in equal proportion to rich and poor countries. And then over the course of the next year, COVAX is hoping to give out something close to 20% of what each of its member countries will need to vaccinate its population. 20% is thought to be enough to cover health workers and most of the most vulnerable people. You look at the publicly available information, there are some questions over that. It might take a little bit longer. I think eventually they will give out that amount of vaccines, but this is an uncertain process, as we're learning even in a place like Europe.
On Monday, Ivory Coast and Ghana were the first to start with vaccines delivered under the UN scheme. Ivory Coast frontline public sector workers and police were the first in line.
Just last week in Ghana and the Ivory Coast, the first COVAX doses were shipped, delivered and actually administered to health workers in both countries.
The supply arrived this morning around 7 a.m. local time. And then the Minister of Health and other dignitaries were at the Kutuka International Airport to receive their vaccines.
And is the demand for vaccines actually universal? I know that there are different levels of vaccine hesitancy in some parts of the world, different levels of suspicion around COVID and different death rates and different lockdowns, etc.
Well, this is one of the things that has just started to come across my radar, at least, is that in places like India, China, Russia, all of which have vaccines, the uptake rate is surprisingly low. Partly in a place like China, it's because they have the virus more or less under control. But in India, government statistics suggest that the vaccine rollout is proceeding at about one-third the pace that they thought it would.
Well, our big focus on the show today, the vaccine drive. India has set a target of inoculating 30 crore people against COVID by July. But for various reasons, the mission is progressing slower than expected.
People just aren't showing up for it. There isn't that same desperation to get vaccinated, partly because the virus is not as disruptive as it's proved to be in some wealthier developed Western countries.
And we've spoken about how governments have acted, but a huge part of this is the commercial side of vaccines. What role do pharmaceutical companies play in the rollout of vaccines?
Well, it varies depending on the company. You have companies like AstraZeneca. They've said that they recognize this is an important product and they should seek to maximize supply to the developing world by making deals with manufacturers like the Serum Institute of India, who can produce vast amounts of vaccine that would go to poorer countries. And AstraZeneca has promised that they will sell the vaccine at a not-for-profit rate for the length of the pandemic. Asterisk there is that they'll decide when the pandemic is over. And also, we haven't actually seen the pricing, so we don't really know what it means to be not-for-profit. In the case of Pfizer, they've opted to treat the COVID-19 vaccine more like a normal product. So they're selling a relatively small amount at a not-for-profit price, and they've made deals with other big companies to help them manufacture more supply, but they don't really see a reason why they shouldn't make a healthy profit off of it.
If you think the economic value, I'm not speaking about the human pain value, that this is, of course, there's no way to measure a human life, I think, that will be saved. And will be saved hundreds of thousands of lives because of this vaccine. But the millions of jobs that will not be lost and hopefully will come back, or the billions of economic value that this successful vaccine will enable, I think it's not appropriate to discuss if we sell it at $19.5 per dose.
That approach has been criticized partly because certainly Moderna and to a lesser extent Pfizer received huge amounts of public funding for the vaccine. So the argument goes that taxpayers invested a lot of money to reduce the risk of trying to develop a vaccine that you didn't know would actually work or not. You sort of publicize the risk and you privatize the profit, and that's been criticized.
Do we have any sense of how big the profits are overall in this?
As one measure of just how much wealth this vaccine is creating, if you look at BioNTech, which is the German company that partnered with Pfizer to create their vaccine, the CEO and founder of that company has gotten $4 billion richer since the beginning of the pandemic. And Moderna's CEO, Stefan Bancel, he gained $4.8 billion in wealth this year. That gives him an overall net worth of $5.3 billion. So, you know, most of his wealth came this year through the discovery of their successful COVID-19 vaccine candidate. Not to single these people out, but the point is to make, this is a big business. There's a lot of money to be made here if you treat it like a commodity.
On those points, Moderna would say that their share price increased because it was such a breakthrough in this particular type of RNA technology. And more broadly, the pharma industry would say they need to make money to enable them to keep research cutting edge.
The point to make here is that pharmaceutical companies will make billions of dollars off of this vaccine. Now, the companies make the argument that intellectual property and patents are actually what allowed them to innovate. to do the things such as creating these COVID-19 vaccines in record time, and that without this intellectual property, they wouldn't have an incentive to invest millions of dollars in research.
Doctors Without Borders knows what's at stake. We've seen the impact on sick people in low-income countries of drug companies profiteering.
Activists and access to medicine campaigners say that there's still a lot of excess capacity out there. There are a lot of companies that could produce the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, even the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, that are currently sitting idle. You know, the labs are empty, no one's using them. And their argument is, well, what's the point of that? If there were ever something that called for suspending the normal rules of business and making sure that as many people as possible can make this vaccine, now would be the time to do that.
Do the right thing. Don't seek or enforce patents on any tests, treatments, or vaccines for COVID-19.
But companies are much more reluctant to give up control and are saying, look, we do want to spread this widely. We want as many people as possible making it, but you should let us choose who makes it and under what circumstances.
Coming up, if sharing vaccines out more equitably is in the interests of the richest countries, can they persuade their voters to back doing it? Michael, in reality, even if there is a successful global scheme, most countries still don't have anything like a significant vaccine program. And the overwhelming majority of the world's population is still waiting for a jab and could be doing so for many years. But you set out why we need to tackle this at a global level, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because if we don't, this pandemic isn't going away for any of us. So given there is that very strong self-interest argument, are politicians in the richer countries trying to make it? Are they trying to argue that we should be helping other countries before perhaps people under 40 get their turn?
Well, one thing we've seen is that governments are aware of this because it just makes sense. What anyone who's looking at the evidence will tell you, that we need to make sure that the world is vaccinated, not just one country. But they clearly think that it's a hard political sell. And I think the evidence for that is that the UK, for example, is not willing to share vaccines as they're being distributed to UK residents. So that they're not willing to say, you know, for every 9 shots we give a British person, 1 shot goes to COVAX, for example. They're making sure to say that we will give you our excess supply, the supply we don't need, once British people don't need it anymore.
Every day that goes by, this programme of vaccination is creating a shield around the entire population, which means that we're now travelling on a one-way road to freedom.
It's a tough sell in the middle of a pandemic that's hit a country like the UK especially hard, to say that, you know, we should be giving away our excess supply, even though it makes total sense to do so. It's the tussle between the desire to sort of protect ourselves first, and then the reality that if everyone did that, the pandemic would go on for years longer than it needed to. That there's a real contradiction here.
Is there a danger that we're in fact heading in the opposite direction for stronger vaccine nationalism with vaccine passports and stricter borders where developing countries' populations are locked out?
That's definitely one manifestation of it, that the vaccine divide will be like a fault line through the decade, you know, really separating the world into places that have been adequately vaccinated and places that are still waiting to be.
Tough new quarantine rules for anyone arriving in England from outside the UK, including fines and the threat of jail for people who flout the rules. The measures are designed to keep coronavirus variants out of the country.
The decisions that leaders make now about how to distribute vaccines will shape the next decade. It will decide whether we have a world in the next few years that is divided between the vaccine haves and have-nots.
Beyond COVID, what does all this mean for the future? What do we need to do to make sure globally we're set up for pandemics that are inevitably going to keep coming? Is anyone thinking bigger about how new global vaccination structures can be built to last beyond this pandemic?
Well, there's already talk of something like COVAX being set up as an institution, not just something that is a response to COVID-19, but is actually a mechanism for distributing vaccines for diseases we already know about, and as well as for viruses and diseases that emerge in the future. Beyond that, public health experts say that we need to understand that we're entering a period of the world in which there are likely to be more pandemics. You know, this century may be one, much like the last century, will be marked by many, many potential pandemics. And so we need to invest in healthcare systems, much better testing and tracing facilities, facilities to be able to sequence viruses. You know, we're 21 years into this century and we've already dealt with SARS, bird flu, MERS, Ebola, swine flu, just to name a few. And now COVID, and you know, people say this isn't even the big one. I know, shocking as that might be. When I talk to people about why some countries have succeeded in fighting this virus and others haven't, they point a lot to governance, which is to say that you can have the best labs in the world, you can have brilliant scientists, but if you don't have a government that knows how to use them, that is willing to coordinate, to understand the threat, then you're going to fail in the face of it. I think that's what we've seen in many wealthier countries.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was Michael Safi, The Guardian's international correspondent. Do follow his reporting and that of all our health and science teams at theguardian.com. You can also find a comment piece on this very subject by the World Health Organization's Director General, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Sammy Kent. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.